This podcast is brought to you compliments of Kaspersky Lab, protecting more than 300 million systems worldwide against internet threats.
Okay, welcome to the Threat Post News Wrap podcast. Plenty to talk about this week with my colleague Mike Mimoso. Mike, we both have, it feels like it's been years, but I guess it's only been a few months that we've been writing about the NSA stuff, and we both wrote a few pieces this week, actually. There was some, not necessarily any new revelations in terms of leaks or new documents that came out, but more from the NSA side, it seems like they're going on a little bit of the, the PR offensive to try and get, win back a little bit of public support here and kind of get people back on their side, if people were ever on their side. I'm not really sure about that. I was at a conference in D.C. on Wednesday where General Alexander was the keynote. And, he spoke for an hour, and probably the first 20 or 25 minutes of it was him talking about the leaks and sort of bringing up 9/11 every third sentence and then blaming the media for a lot of this. Like, as if the media had somehow contrived all of this and none of it was true and none of these documents were legitimate or anything like that.
I was getting ready to blame you and blame myself. Every time I look in the mirror, I can't stand myself anymore.
It's confirmed this week.
So
destroyed my self-confidence. Yeah. It was a really sort of odd thing. And then he did it again yesterday, speaking in front of the Senate Select Intelligence Committee, which you wrote about today. And it just seems like they're trying, it seems like a very concerted effort to shift the narrative away from, whatever potential abuses there might be at the NSA and any discussion of whether these collection programs are necessary or legal or whatever, and just shift it completely away from that and onto like the problem of the leaks and why the media hates the NSA.
Yeah, there's some definite PR 101 stuff going on at the NSA this week for sure. I mean, the Senate Intelligence Committee meeting, the hearing yesterday, those things are usually behind closed doors. And then for the first time, I guess in a long time, they made it public and they were streaming it on C-SPAN and so forth. And, the Senate Intelligence Committee is obviously the oversight committee for the intelligence community, and it's a friendly community, and there were a lot of softball questions kind of tossed at these guys. I mean, there were a couple of senators in there, Senator Wyden from Oregon and Udall from Utah, I believe, who peppered Alexander with some good questions. But for the most part, it was friendly territory for him. So you're right. They're definitely trying to bring the public back into their corner. I don't know if it's working. There's always kind of this inherent mistrust of what these guys do anyway, and they certainly haven't helped themselves. But, you can definitely starting to see that damage control kind of operation in motion.
Yeah, and it's weird because, it's, about 4 months after the fact when all this stuff started. And, B, for most of the NSA's existence, I don't know exactly when it started, but you're talking several decades, they haven't really had to worry about what the public thinks. To the extent that the public was aware of the NSA, they assumed that they only were concerned with, foreign surveillance.
Right.
So they never cared what the American public thought. They only cared what, essentially the Senate Oversight Committee thinks and what the president thinks. So this is obviously all new ground for them, and having to try and repair their public image is sort of a weird thing for them, I would guess.
Yeah, I mean, you and I were talking about it this morning that, everything in D.C. kind of happens in its own little bubble, and these guys are breaking out probably for the first time. So it's got to be a little different for them, and they're still feeling their way through it. I mean, before June 5th or 6th, whenever all this broke, how many people in this country knew exactly what the NSA was all about and what they did and what their charter was? Probably, a minority of Americans knew exactly what was going on. Now, awareness is a little higher, and it's not painted. You know, the NSA isn't painted in a very good light for the most part. They've got to try and crawl out from under that.
No, I mean I grew up in D.C. and the joke always was in that area. You know, NSA was no such agency. Like it did. You know, right. It didn't exist. Like if you,
like Roswell,
you know,
didn't exist.
Yeah, totally. Right. Exactly. Except it has its own exit off the Beltway. And, you know, everybody knew it existed, but nobody had a very clear picture of what they did until, you know, James Bamford started writing those books about
them.
And, you know, as great as the work he did was, the stuff that's come out in the last 4 months, whether you agree with the way that it's come out or you don't, has given us a much clearer picture of what some of the work they do is. And one of the things that I wrote about today was, you know, I understand that the intelligence agencies and the law enforcement community needs these kind of tools to get their job done. And I think everybody understands that. Like, you know, there's legitimate uses for these kinds of surveillance programs or intelligence collection programs or whatever. But there's also so much room for abuse when you're collecting, you know, essentially the metadata on every phone call that's made in the United States. Like you can't guarantee that no one is going to abuse that database. You know, we've seen it happen in other agencies like the IRS.
Right.
And, you know, the temptation is huge, even if it's for, you know, somewhat legitimate purposes. Like we think that perhaps this person is connected to this person and we probably have the data in this database. Let's go find it, even if we don't have total probable cause or reasonable suspicion or whatever. It's, you know, it's just a question of whether it's necessary to use these tools the way that they're being used.
Right. I mean, look at Snowden. I mean, he abused his access, and, you know, you can look at him as a hero or as a traitor, but he had enormous access and he leaked it and was very noisy about it. And everybody knows now, he's starting to see what was in those documents that he took, and the depths of the surveillance that the NSA is using against not just foreigners, but Americans. Mm-hmm. What about people who are, you know, could be in that network and aren't as noisy as about it, and, you know, using it to their advantage quietly, like, you know, a criminal organization or terrorist organization? They're not going to be as noisy about it. And, you know, the NSA, they're in a weird catch-22. I mean, they got hammered yesterday. Alexander got hammered yesterday by one of the senators about, you know, this whole project, this whole operation deceives the public. But they need to be quiet. They need to be stealthy. They can't come out and say, yeah, we're collecting everything, or you'll tip off the terrorists too. Weird kind of dynamic that they, you know, that they've kind of painted themselves into a corner with.
It is, and they're relying so much on that on that terror link.
Yeah.
On, you know, using the failures of the intelligence community leading up to 9/11 as, you know, sort of the foundation for why they need these programs. That's what Alexander said yesterday many times, and he said it on Wednesday as well in his speech, and he said it in the, you know, over the summer several times, is, you know, the intelligence community was blamed after 9/11 for not connecting these dots,
right?
You know, for not having the proper methods and information sharing and all that kind of stuff to say, okay, well, this guy in the Middle East is communicating with this guy in San Diego who turns out to be one of the hijackers. We blew that because we didn't have the right programs. So now we need this Section 215 metadata collection, and we need every single phone call so that we can't possibly miss anything. And once you go down that road and start saying, okay, you know, terrorism is the reason for all this. If you don't let us do this, the terrorists win, blah, blah, blah. It's a really, like, you can't unwind that. Like, they have to keep going with that.
Right.
And they have the, I don't know whether it's an advantage or disadvantage, because people only hear about, like, the failures of intelligence agencies, right? Like 9/11. We never know when they do something really well and disrupt, you know, some potentially big operation. So they can just sort of point to it and be like, all that stuff's classified, it's working.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
That's what, like, they keep hammering on, too, is that there's stuff we can't tell you. Yes, I mean, Alexander even said it. If we didn't have 215 of the Patriot Act, then there would be a lot more successful terror operations in this country and abroad against Americans. And, you know, who knows if he's right or wrong. I mean, there comes a point where, you know, they would have to declassify a lot more than they want to prove their point and to justify what they're doing. And, you know, they're gonna tug at Americans' heartstrings and play that 9/11 card, whether it's legit or not, to their advantage. And that's what they're doing. And it's part of this, you know, PR campaign that they've got going on.
Yeah, and the thing that I was at in D.C., it was a very sympathetic audience, obviously, because it's all government folks and, you know, former military and law enforcement and that sort of thing. So they all...
Yeah, he got a standing ovation, didn't he, at the end?
He did, actually. Yeah, he got a standing ovation, which there was a bunch of other reporters in the room, and we sort of looked at each other like, huh.
Yeah.
what's going on here? That's not something you usually see.
Yeah, you guys were in a weird room.
It was very weird. Yeah, it was very odd. I mean, before the speech, Alexander came and like sat at the table that I was sitting at, you know, with his Secret Service guys and his PR team, and they were all chatting before the thing, which was just so like Alice in Wonderland. It was just a weird 5 minutes.
Did you say hi?
I did not. I sort of nodded at him, and you know, he smiled, and you know, was, you know, complaining about this dental surgery he had the day before or something, which is kind of funny. But I think I'm completely worn out by all the NSA stuff, as I know you are, and probably the audience as well. But the other big story that we wrote about, and I think everybody else in the world wrote about this week, was the Ice Fog cyber espionage campaign that the Kaspersky Gray team released a report on, actually on the same day, on Wednesday. Kurt Baumgartner gave a talk at that same conference I was at on this. And it was really interesting to me because we've gotten used to a lot of these APT reports, and they all sort of follow a similar narrative and you know, path. And they sort of describe the group and the reconnaissance and, you know, the targets they hit and, you know, here's the tools that they use. And, okay, we traced it back to China, or we traced it back to, you know, North Korea or whatever, and you know, they're stealing intellectual property. But there was a couple, you know, sort of novel things in what they uncovered, and I think the biggest one was the fact that it looks like the team, at least behind this operation, isn't necessarily a cohesive team. It's just a bunch of sort of contractors being hired to go after you know, seemingly random targets, get in, get what they want, get out, and then they move on to the next one. And if you just look at them as, you know, discrete operations, it never really makes any sense, or there's no reason to connect them. But, you know, part of the work that Kurt and the other guys did was tying this all together and saying, oh no, these are all connected and here's how.
Right. Yeah. They're kind of borrowing a page from cybercrime gangs, where they hire different people to build different parts of different functionality within a botnet or whatever. And these guys apparently were hired to do, you know, kind of hit and run, as our researchers put it, within this campaign. I mean, the campaign, like you said, is pretty straightforward APT. It's spear phishing and a lot of backdoors, dropping malware that, you know, a lot of password grabbers, a lot of Trojans opening backdoors and installing more malware. But it looks like that there's this component that, you know, these guys get in and out. And the research paper that we had from our guys, and Kurt talked about it too, they likened them to mercenaries, where they're hired to do this one project and they get out. And it's definitely a shift. I don't think we've heard that on the APT side of things, on the state-sponsored kind of espionage side of things.
Yeah, I think, you know, we always assume like, okay, those state-sponsored attackers, whatever state it happens to be, they've got enough firepower, you know, on retainer. They don't really need to go out and hire freelancers to do these jobs. But there's probably some advantages to that, in that you can sort of compartmentalize these things and say, okay, this three-person team, here's some tools. We want you to go after this shipbuilding company. And then this five-person team over here, here's some different tools. We want you to go after this supplier of, you know, heads-up displays for fighter jets in the U.S. And None of them know each other. They have no reason to think that they're part of a larger operation, and they can sort of, you know, keep everything separate that way.
Yeah, I mean, you got to think that it's pretty efficient. They can specialize. They can they can tailor attacks to particular targets. And then, you know, the fun part is trying to figure out where it's all going and what they're using it for. I mean, you've got pretty disparate targets there. I mean, they're hitting media companies with this particular campaign. Yeah. Like you mentioned, a shipbuilder, some government agencies, some university research projects. You know, it's hard to tell whether it's a mass collection of data just for the heck of it, trying to pick up something of interest, or whether there's a particular purpose to this campaign, I guess remains to be seen. But they're pretty diverse, too, with the malware they were using, the Windows stuff. They had a beta version of a Mac version of the malware that they were testing on some Chinese bulletin boards that I guess they were just trying to see who they can infect and how, because there was really no payload component to it. Mm-hmm. Which was pretty interesting. So, you know, a lot of different characteristics and features of this attack, but what definitely stood out was that kind of hit-and-run nature to it.
Yeah, maybe that's a compliment for Apple that their OS X market share is big enough that they're now being targeted by cyber espionage attackers.
Yep,
congratulations.
Sure. Wasn't that long ago we didn't even consider them, and now look at it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, your afterthought. You might as well write a Commodore 64 version. But, yeah, when I was talking to Kurt the other day before his talk, and I was just talking about, you know, how it went about the research and everything, and I said, you know, this sounds like it's kind of fun, like, you know, trying to connect all these things and look for little hints here and little pieces over there and all that, and he got a big smile. He's like, oh, man, it's so much fun.
Yeah.
It's so, you know, it's so interesting, and, you know, they're working odd hours trying to match up when the attackers work and all that kind of thing. It's kind of the, you know, it looks like the most fun you can have with that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's pretty cool detective work too.
Definitely. Yeah. So it's been an interesting, week in terms of all of this stuff. So, it's, next week I'm going over to Berlin for the Virus Bulletin Conference, which should be interesting. We have a few guys speaking there, and that's an odd show because it's small, and there's such a insular sort of, you know, the anti-malware crowd there.
Right.
It's almost all them sort of talking to each other. But you also, now with all this APT stuff going on and cyber espionage, you also have the chance to, like, talk to all these guys that are doing that kind of high level research all the time. And just get their thoughts on, you know, where all this is going and who's attacking who, and, you know, who are the big guys on the block and that sort of thing. So it should be interesting.
I'm sure you'll get some good stuff out of it. It's a good crowd there.
Yeah, it should be fun. So, all right. Well, I'll probably talk to you after that, get another podcast in the can. And, I'm sure by the time I get back, there will be 12 other NSA stories to have broken. I'm going to let you handle those, though.
I'm sure we'll talk NSA next time.
All right, man. Have a good weekend.
You too.
Take care.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Compliments to Kaspersky Lab, a world leader in internet threat protection for small, medium, and large enterprises. Visit Kaspersky.com for more information about their line of premium protection solutions.